This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, Vice President of Security Technology at Synopsys and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Synopsys and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.synopsys.com/silverbullet. This is the 138th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have today with me, Nicole Perlroth. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, Gary.
Nicole Perlroth covers cybersecurity for the New York Times and the Bits blog. Before joining the San Francisco Bureau in 2011, she was deputy editor at Forbes, where she covered venture capital and web startups. Nicole is the recipient of several journalism awards for her reporting on efforts by the Chinese government to steal military and industrial trade secrets. She has a BA in poli-sci and Near Eastern Studies from Princeton and an MA in journalism from Stanford, and is a native of the Bay Area where she still lives. So thanks for joining us today, Nicole.
Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan, Gary.
According to rumor, the first pitch you ever did landed you on the front page of Sunday's Post, so do tell.
Oh, I love that you found that. Yes, so I did not do anything with journalism. I didn't go to, I didn't work for a student paper. I didn't ever have any ambitions of being a journalist. I'd gone to some, an expensive college where I did nothing with my education towards journalism. And then I took some jobs after Princeton that a lot of Princeton graduates take. Like, I was a consultant for a little while. I worked on Capitol Hill for a little while. I worked in marketing for Coach, the handbag company, for a little while, and I just thought all of these jobs were completely mind-numbing, and I just missed any kind of intellectual stimulation. So I ended up actually taking in one of those adult continuing studies classes at NYU at night while I was working at Coach by day, and the guy who taught the class, it was a feature writing class. I just sort of missed writing. And the guy who taught the class was John Crudell, who's a business columnist at the New York Post. And he said, you have some skills here. I think you should try freelancing. And actually, he gave me an assignment. He was trying to help me out. So at that time, there'd been some New York Post stories about a rat fiasco.
Oh, I remember that.
Bell KFC. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, some of your listeners may remember someone found, like, rats doing cartwheels in the back of this Taco Bell KFC. So he said, why don't you do a freelance story for the New York Post about how it's not just Taco Bell, it's, per se, and all these expensive restaurants probably have rat problems, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, okay, so, again, by day, I'm, like, working at this luxury handbag company, and by night, I'm going through the Department of Health's restaurant records to see, which of these nice restaurants had rat problems. And what I found was this restaurant that I really liked. I'd actually had just eaten at them at the restaurant a week earlier.
Oh, no.
One of the most horrific health records I'd seen. It was like cockroaches and rats and just, people smoking, not washing their hands, not cleaning the toilets. I mean, it was kind of horrendous. So, but I couldn't really wrap my head around it because I'd just been there and it was really clean.
Right.
And it was a good restaurant. So anyways, I called them and I said, I happened upon your health record and I really can't parse this because I was just at your restaurant. It seemed pretty clean and sanitary to me. And they said, well, thanks for calling. Actually, the health inspector came to our restaurant to do his review, and he ended up getting drunk at the bar and passing out for 2 hours. And we think he just made a bunch of stuff up on our report to justify to his supervisor why it took him so long to do the inspection. So I said, oh, my God, you got to be kidding me. If only there were proof of this. We should get this guy. And they said, well, actually, we have, a camera in the restaurant that caught some of it.
So there was proof.
There was proof. So I go to the New York Post. I had no idea what I had. I sort of sheepishly walk into the New York Post, and I say, you know, I'm really sorry I didn't get to do this assignment, you know, the way that you envisioned it. But I did end up getting this video footage of this health inspector, you know, drunk, passed out at this bar and then stealing this restaurant and making up this whole report. So lo and behold, you know, they couldn't believe I didn't really know what I had. But right. It went on the cover of the Sunday's New York Post with this great headline that said something like, "Rat Nap, you know, Inspector Snoozo." And, you know, I was like 23 at the time. And I went to the corner bodega and bought out every single New York Post there.
Awesome.
Yeah. And I was just hooked. I mean, I you know, the guy was fired. The Department of Health had to have new rules for, you know, for their inspections. And, you know, there had to be some follow-up with the restaurants. And, you know, it's just to see the impact of something that started out as such a silly assignment was pretty cool. And so that was my first article.
That's really interesting. So I was going to ask you what got you into covering information security, but if you start with rats, why not just keep on going?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I did not choose information security. I was actually, while I was at Forbes, I was based in Silicon Valley, and I was covering venture capital, really in the sort of heat up ahead of Facebook's IPO, and I was covering a lot of the investors and some of the private share sales, and so I got a couple cover stories in Forbes, and I got this call one day from Damon Darlin, who's a beloved editor of mine at the New York Times, who said, you know, we're looking at you for this job. It's not venture, though. I should tell you, it's cybersecurity. And I just remember thinking, like,
what the heck?
Take me off this, like, you want to take me off this gravy train to go cover cybersecurity? So I really honestly didn't think I was qualified. I just sort of told myself, well, it's an honor to get invited into the New York Times building and go out to New York for these interviews, and I'll just be myself and see what comes of it. That was an interesting interview experience. But lo and behold, I ended up getting the job, and sort of the rest is history.
They sold you, it sounds like.
I wouldn't call it that. I had to do 13 interviews in one day, if I'm remembering that correctly. It was like half-hour interviews each. And some of them were great. I was interviewing with Sam Sifton, who was our food critic at the time. So I was just fascinated to be meeting him and asking him, like, how do you be a food critic and not gain 100 pounds? And, but then some of the interviews were really unpleasant, and people were like, you know, you're the least qualified candidate.
Yeah, why are you here? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, why are you here? Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, so, somebody like you rises to that occasion.
Oh, thanks. Well, I think, you know, I said, you know, you really should interview this person and this person. You know, I've been doing research for this interview, and their cybersecurity coverage is really great.
Right.
And they said they did look at that person and that person, but when they came in to interview, the editors had no idea what they were talking about.
Right. So
which,
it needed,
you know,
to be
a big problem.
Coverage for normals.
Security.
Yeah,
they needed coverage for normies. That's right.
Yep. So how does that be compared to the others you've covered? I mean, you've sort of talked about that, but give me a minute or two on that.
About some of the other, how it compares to some of the other topics I've covered.
Yeah.
So, you know, venture capital was an interesting beat because it's very self-promotional. You get a lot of calls from venture capitalists trying to get you to write a glowing profile of them, which is similar in some ways to information security, because, as you know, we constantly get pitched by cybersecurity firms or firms that want to slap the word cyber onto their website, looking for promotion and willing to just shamelessly dole out FUD in the process.
Yep.
So dealing with the self-promoters it was very good training for me.
I love
in covering the venture capitalists.
Yeah.
The hard part is you know, I always say, like, it's no longer even the reporting and writing that's the hardest part of my job these days. It's the day after the story publishes on Twitter.
Right.
When, you know, when you're writing for a layperson's audience, the technical audience is never going to be happy
yep.
with how you're covering information security, as you know. And so dealing with such a hypercritical, vocal, you know, philosophical, almost like religious community, I think has been the hardest part. And I don't think anything really prepared me for that.
Mm, that's really interesting. So you've been involved with some really big stories, including the recent story, Russian election hacking efforts wider than previously known. So what was it like to be locked in a room working on that one?
So that one, I wasn't really locked in a room. I was actually working from home for most of it. And the original assignment there, you know, we don't get too many assignments at the New York Times, especially when you're covering something like information security, because there's more than enough news to cover. But occasionally you get these assignments from the powers that be. So mm-hmm. the assignment started as, you know, can you look out ahead of the 2018 elections and see what's being done to prevent another situation like the one we had in 2016?
Mm-hmm.
So I started digging around, and what I found was that actually there were still many more unresolved issues from the 2016 election than had been covered by the mainstream media. So one of the things that was so soothing after the election was, you know, we knew Russia had done a series of disinformation campaigns. We knew about the propaganda efforts, although at that point we didn't know the extent of them. And that's still coming out now.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, the intelligence report that came out last January delivered a pretty soothing message that said, despite all those efforts to influence the 2016 campaign, Russia stopped short of hacking the actual vote counts, the vote tallies.
Right.
And what I learned in the reporting is that actually that conclusion came predominantly from spies, from spies that we have that and digital intercepts of Russian communications, where I'm assuming someone told someone else something along the lines of, you know, we didn't hack the vote count, and they were really surprised that Trump had won without those efforts.
Right.
But no real forensic effort had been made to be sure that some of the systems that were hacked on the back end didn't have an impact on the vote.
Like the logbook things.
Exactly. And the place that really kept coming up again and again in my conversations was Durham, North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, the county did use a e-poll book, electronic poll book vendor called VR Systems that we know from a leaked NSA report had successfully been hacked by the Russian GRU. And they did have a lot of the problems on election day that fit sort of the MO of someone trying to create chaos or prevent people from voting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then I don't have to tell you about the demographics of Durham, but it's a predominantly blue county in a swing state. So we started digging further, and we found that there were these instances of people showing up with their registration cards and being told that, no, they were no longer registered.
Right.
Or they'd been marked as inactive, or they'd voted early when they hadn't, or they'd voted absentee when they hadn't.
Yeah,
and
fishy.
Written off to a glitch. Exactly. It was written off to a glitch, but no one had ever done any forensics investigation. And then where it got really deep in the weeds was when I found out actually the county had hired a local forensics or, you know, security company to do some forensics investigation. And so I got my hands on that report, and it was like, you know, not like anything you would read from a Mandiant or
right.
CrowdStrike, or
right.
you know, it was really like a old school cop report where they had gone to these poll workers and
right.
said, you know, at 6:09 I interviewed Judy from
right.
precinct number 3, but there was no actual forensics analysis, and the DHS and FBI had never done any kind of analysis of these systems in Durham because they have to be invited in by the county and the state. and the state had really rebuffed their efforts. So it basically, we started unraveling this, and we realized that this tale was more common than we knew. And I wish we could have got into the bottom of, did hacking actually occur on election day? And I regret that we weren't able to get that far, but we're still sort of staying on top of that one.
Yeah, I hope that story gets more attention. We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, make sure to check out my other projects on GaryMcGraw.com. There you can find writings, videos, and even original music. So it seems really easy to cover spectacular failures like the Equifax fax breach.
Oh, yeah.
You know, due to what I call the NASCAR effect, because humans love to read about disasters. But how do we get coverage for important but not really sexy computer security stuff like, oh, I don't know, say software security? Asking for a friend.
Well, yeah. I mean, I agree with you. Some days I feel like I'm on the cop beat, you know, like tragedy struck Equifax on Tuesday morning.
Right. Blood cells.
You know, you're just like, yeah, exactly. But as far as software security, I mean, I think people are getting more interested in it. I know in my book, I'm hoping to sort of end on software security because I think there's just more awareness now of vulnerabilities and just how big of an impact human error and sloppiness can have in terms of attacks. I mean, there was a big focus actually in the Equifax breach, at least initially, on the Apache vulnerability that wasn't patched.
Yep.
So
and Craig Timberg talked about it explicitly in the post, so that was cool.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and, you know, one thing that gave me hope was when Facebook was IPOing, and I just know this from my venture beat days, you know, their philosophy was move fast and break things.
Right.
And recently, I forget how recently, but I was at Facebook headquarters, and that motto had been replaced, and I don't know what audience I'm speaking to right now, so forgive my French, but there were signs on the wall that said, move slowly and fix your shit. And I just thought that was a great ray of sunshine in an otherwise dreary space.
Well, I think so, too. And Alex is a really good guy, so his influence is very clearly seen over there.
Oh, yeah.
Adult supervision.
And, you know, at Google, the amount of fuzzing that's going on, and, you know, they say that their motto since the Chinese attack that happened there in 2010 has been, never again, you know, that security and software security is extremely important to them.
Mm-hmm.
How that trickles down to Android, I don't know. But, you know, it's something that's getting talked about, I think, pretty seriously at the executive level at some of these tech companies, which is a good sign.
Mm-hmm. I've been working on a new science project about CISOs, about who you wrote about, I guess, 3 years ago. In your story, A Tough Corporate Job Asks One Question, Can You Hack It? Very hilarious.
Right.
Hilarious.
What, didn't someone say
lead.
It was like a lamb being a lamb, lambs waiting for their slaughter?
Exactly. And you ended with the three envelope joke. So, though an 18-month tenure is still all too common in CISOs, I think some have made some real progress in the role. So, do you think that CISOs are doomed to be the guy before the guy? Still, or are you seeing forward progress?
I'm so glad you brought that story up, because I think that was the case at the time. And now you look at, you know, some of those CISOs who've been through those breaches are now, you know, like top 10 recruits at companies, because now that we've all admitted that we've all been hacked, you want someone that's sort of a veteran of some serious nation state hacks to be protecting your business, because they understand that compliance checklists aren't going to cut it anymore.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think that has changed. And I do think that it's some of the people who worked at these high profile companies that are most in demand. I think, unfortunately, Equifax executives, you know, they were fired in the wake of this most recent breach. I don't know if they're going to have the same clout with future employers that some others have had, but yeah, I think it is changing. I don't think I also think it's now it's not the CISO that gets fired; it's the the CEO.
Right.
So that
changes things just a little bit. It's kind of like what Sarbanes-Oxley did. You know, all of a sudden the CEO goes to jail. They don't do jail. They do limo.
Right. Right.
So you've had some of your stories optioned for TV and movies. Tell us about the Krebs story very briefly.
So Brian Krebs is probably very familiar to your audience.
Yep.
And I think he's the best at what he does in terms of my competitors. I don't even consider him a competitor because he's writing for a different audience. And
yep.
He's just so good at what he does. You know, I was basically at his mercy when he was covering the Target attack, because every day it was like I was no longer doing any original reporting. I was just waking up.
According to Krebs, blah, blah.
Exactly. And we all were, you know, Wall Street Journal,
yep.
Wired, you know, we were all just writing what Brian was doing that day.
Right.
And it got old pretty quickly. And finally I just said, you know what, Brian is actually a really interesting coverage topic in his own right. I mean, the guy has been swatted, and I knew some of the stories about people sending heroin to his doorstep.
Yep.
And that kind of thing.
He told some of those stories on a version of Silver Bullet a few months ago.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I just, New York Times readers didn't know any
yep.
of those stories, and I don't think many of them really knew who Brian was, although they should have known because he was the first to report a lot of these stories. So I pitched that to my editors, and I told them all the juicy details about the swatting and the heroin and feces being sent to his house, and they loved it. So I wrote that one up, and Sony bought the options to it, which was sort of a funny story in itself, because I went home to my now husband and said, "We're going to be rich. You know, Sony optioned my story. Go get some champagne.
Yeah,
get
right.
the nice kind." And the next day, I talked to our lawyers at the Times, and they said, "Well,
it happens all the time. It's just an option.
It happens all the time after legal fees, and the New York Times takes its 50%
right,
cut.
Right.
It basically left me with like $300.
Well, that's one good bottle of champagne. What the heck?
Well, I actually, it's funny, I told my husband, you know, we should have bought wine coolers.
So, all right, now a touchy subject. So you're working on the book, This Is How They Tell Me
yeah.
the World Will End.
Yeah.
What's the deal yeah. with the book?
Well.
Sorry.
Let's just say I've been a little busy at work.
Yep.
So it's been hard to balance the two things. You know, it's hard to investigate Russian hacking by day and then come home and have anything left for a book about the exploit market.
Yep.
But that's what the book is about. And my final manuscript is due Christmas Eve. And after that, they're going to start docking my advance. So I have no choice but to finish the book in the next couple months. And, you know, the fact that it's gotten delayed has actually been a good thing, because I think the ending of the book about the exploit market, that would be a really great ending, is what we've just seen over the last couple of months with
mm-hmm.
the shadow brokers leaks
mm-hmm.
and the NSA exploits being used by
we can't wait.
North Korea.
So we're
oh,
we're psyched.
Okay.
All the readers are waiting for that. So hurry up.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Well, it's hard not to think of your listeners while I'm writing the book, and all the people who are going to tell me I got something technically wrong.
Oh, that's okay.
Explain this or that, but I'm getting used to that.
So one other question. Sitting on the journalist side of the table as a New York Times reporter gives you lots of power. So do you experience the same kind of sexism that other women in tech experience?
I'll tell you. So I do not experience the type of sexism that you read about in some of the articles on
mm-hmm.
Uber.
Mm-hmm.
I have not experienced that. What I have experienced is, first of all, you know, people talk about women in tech and how we need more women in tech.
Mm-hmm.
And I always just roll my eyes because I'm like, try cybersecurity.
Yeah, right. There's plenty of room there.
Right. It's like you're preaching to the choir, only My choir is a lot smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And so that creates an interesting dynamic. But, you know, I'll tell you a funny story, which is that I went to go hear Mike Rogers, the head of the NSA, director of the NSA, go speak at Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
And he was speaking to an audience of Stanford students and academics. And there were reporters there, and all my usual competitors were there. So I'm sitting in the audience, and it's time for questions. And I have my hand raised, and I'm trying to ask him a question, but he's calling on all my competitors. And finally, he said, okay, now I'd like to hear from some Stanford student. Why don't I choose this nice, lovely lady in the front?
Oh,
and,
man.
And it was like Nicole Cora, New York Times. So I get a lot of that, which is fine. I think actually I've learned it can be a superpower, and people sometimes feel more comfortable talking to me because I'm a woman writing for a lay audience.
Right. So they dish when they probably shouldn't.
Exactly.
And you're a hardcore journalist, it turns out.
Yes, I catch them. they're most vulnerable.
So I have to brag a little bit. Over the last 12 months of Silver Bullet, we've interviewed 12 accomplished women, including Marie Moe, Leslie Carhart, Kelly Lum, Jesse Irwin, Kate Pierce, Changsi Wang, Cheryl Biswas, Kelly Jackson Higgins, Ksenia Dmitrieva Puergo, which is impossible to pronounce, Pavi Ramamurthy, and Wafa Mamili, and now you. So incredible talent, ambition, and drive. And what one thing should we all do to encourage more women to join cybersecurity? Not, you know, reporting too, all technical stuff. What do you think?
Well, first of all, that list gives me chills, and I just think it's wonderful that you've lined up some of those women that you listed are all fans of all of them. Secondly, to get more women into cybersecurity, I don't think we play up the sex appeal of cybersecurity enough. I mean, this is something that is changing all the time. You're not just coding, you know, on the technical side, you're not just coding, you're like playing cops and robbers. And I think that there is just constant, you know, I talked earlier about how little intellectual stimulation there was in some of these jobs I had,
right,
particularly, you know, in marketing at Coach, where I worked with all women.
Yeah.
And this job, you know, the cybersecurity world is just full of intellectual stimulation. It's amazing how many times three days ago, I knew nothing about North Korean counterfeiting operations, but I had to go quickly study up on it because of the financially motivated attacks North Korea has been doing to make up for the fact that its counterfeiting operations are no longer as effective. So it's not like I'm just buried in code. You're actually
real reporting.
And you're sort of on the front lines of history in some cases. And there's a real political bent to a lot of the nation state type attacks that we're seeing. So I think we just, I don't think people realize that it's not just code, and it's not just hackers in their basements, that there's real opportunities here to be on the front lines of history. And cybersecurity is such a, talk about employment security. You know, the problem's only getting worse and worse.
Yep.
So there's real opportunities here. And I actually met a young woman the other day who was going to Johns Hopkins, and she had sought out a internship related to cybersecurity for the summer, which that was the first I'd heard of a, you know, freshman co-ed seeking a job out like this. Most people just sort of fall into it.
Right.
And so that, I thought that was a nice thing to hear.
Yeah, that's cool. That's a great answer. So last question, Total Flyer. How many dogs do you have? Is it three?
Have one and a half. I know, it's pretty confusing.
It's hard to tell.
I have one dog. I know. I'm obsessed with dogs. So I have one dog named Homer.
Uh-huh.
He's my main, he's what I call our silent partner.
Okay.
He's with me all the time, although not right at this moment. And
trying to make you not write the book. Throw the ball.
Yes.
Don't write the book.
Exactly.
Throw the ball.
Yes, exactly. he's a real distractor. So, distractor. And then I just got a puppy who's a Swiss Mountain Dog.
Ah, so there's only one of those. I was thinking there were two of those.
Well, he is a cousin of my family's Swiss Mountain Dog that they got nine months ago.
That makes sense.
So he was inspired by this other dog.
Okay, so two. That's not so
right.
bad.
And we haven't totally named the new puppy yet, but I like the name Hanzo, like Hattori Hanzo, the sword maker in Kill Bill,
nice.
The Japanese ninja.
Nice.
But I'm getting some pushback, so I'll keep you posted.
All right, very last, what's your favorite place to dive on the planet?
My favorite place to skydive, I've skydived in really ugly places, so New Jersey and... Lodi, California.
There you go.
Couldn't tell you which one was better.
Hey, thanks for your time, Nicole. It's been a really interesting conversation.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, and thanks for bringing all these inspiring women on.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Synopsys and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The July-August issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is a special issue devoted to post-quantum cryptography. It also features our interview with Kelly Lum, a.k.a. Aloria. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.synopsys.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.